Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Because of the amount of debt that was priced pre-2022, that over the coming years will get repriced much higher. And if rates stay higher for a while, there's obviously sort of this pernicious death by a thousand cuts impact.
Hello and welcome to Wealthion. I'm your host, Andrew Brill. Now that we are past the most recent Fed decision to leave rates unchanged, let's get to talking about what comes next. And we'll do that right now. The date of our next online conference is June 1st. We have some of the most prominent names in economics and equities coming to talk about how we can all keep and grow our own wealth. We hope you'll join us. For details, go to our website, Wealthion.com. We welcome in Peter Buchvar, an independent economist, market strategist. He independently produces the Book Report, which contains a wealth of information. He's the chief investment officer of Bleakley Financial Group. Peter, welcome back to Wealthion.
Thanks, Andrew, for having me on.
So, Peter, we have a stubborn inflation number. The Fed obviously leaving rates for longer. What's your take on the economy as we sit right now?
I think that the economy is remarkably mixed and uneven. And I say that even with individual industries. Take housing, for example. We have the pace of existing home sales near 30-year lows, but new builds that are doing fine, filling up this supply vacuum. With consumer spending, we have lower to middle income consumers that are skimping on Starbucks coffees and McDonald's cheeseburgers, but we have the high end that is still spending and traveling and going on cruises and so on. You have manufacturing that's still in contraction, even though it's trying to find signs of a bottom, but we have all this government spending and government enticements to build manufacturing facilities and chip plants and so on. Global trade that is somewhat mixed, with soft economies overseas in Europe, but then you have strength in India, weakness in China. So a tremendous amount of cross currents. So you can't really paint the U.S. economy with one brush. There's sort of this sort of two-lane economic highway that I'm seeing.
So we talk about, there's so much talk about recession, soft landing. What you're trying to explain to me is that there's different parts of the economy that could be in recession now, but certain parts that are kind of doing okay.
Yeah, that's what it seems. The person, as I said earlier, that's not going to Starbucks as much, they're sort of in their own personal recession, having to deal with a cumulative rise of 20% in their cost of living, hopefully at least offset as much as possible with wage growth. But it still stings, and I think consumers are really prioritizing on more needs than wants. But as I said, higher income consumers are benefiting from a return on their savings of 5% if they're in treasuries, and a wealth situation that is on firmer footing than a lower income consumer that is renting and doesn't own a home relative to somebody else that may own a home and has a locked-in 30-year mortgage at 3.5%.
Is that a switch from what you've seen in the not-so-distant past, is that people were, the discretionary spending was really, really high. Now we see, which what you're explaining is that the discretionary spending is kind of, in certain income groups, is waning, and in certain income groups, is just continuing to grow.
Well, you know, COVID certainly definitely, you know, polluted and pulled forward a lot of spending on discretionary stuff, particularly on goods. We know that was where the consumer spending strength was in late 2020, 2021. And then that flipped after everyone already bought their laptops and bought their redid their kitchens and redid their deck and spent on stuff. Then they shifted to spending on going out for dinner and traveling and more experiential type stuff. That trend seems to still be in place, where experiential type consumer spending is doing better than hard good stuff, particularly if it's an expensive hard good stuff like a car, where you have to borrow money, and the cost of money to buy that car is obviously much higher than it was pre-2022.
Especially for the government. Do you see the higher for longer? Is it working, Peter? It seems to be stuck in that, just under three, just over three range. Do you see it starting to get down to where the Fed wants it?
Well, strangely, it's working in some areas, but it's also counterintuitively facilitating inflation on the other. On the higher end, because you're getting a lot of interest income, you're spending a lot keeping prices elevated. Cruise lines, for example, to say them again, they have a lot of pricing power right now because of those boomers that are spending. So higher interest rates are actually inflationary if you're trying to buy tickets for a cruise or a sporting event, for example, or a concert. Look at the housing industry. Home prices continue to go up in the face of higher interest rates. So in that case, because of the distortive nature of the Fed's policy of going back 20 years with what they've done to the housing market, it's completely failed in reducing the inflation of home prices. On the flip side, cheap money drove an enormous amount of multifamily construction. So their attempt to create inflation actually sowed the seeds for eventual rental deflation. But now we're sowing the seeds for an eventual uptick in rental inflation in 2025, 2026, due to the dearth of new construction after the current projects are done. So it's hard to answer that question in one way because there's so many nuances in how rate cuts, rate increases flow through the economy. But I guess to simplify it, if you need to borrow money to build a business, if you need to borrow money to buy a house or a car, well, yeah, it's working. If you're in commercial real estate, higher interest rates are certainly working because we've seen certainly a collapse in the values of a lot of office buildings, and we're seeing stress in other areas of commercial real estate. So it's working in some areas and it's creating more inflation in others.
And since you mentioned commercial real estate, I'll ask you the question. I know there's a lot of commercial loans that are coming due this year. Those loans are going to have to be refinanced at a very much higher rate, probably double than what some of these people are paying. And the property
More than
values,
double, it'll be potentially triple.
and the property values, because of the higher rates, have come down. How is this going to affect the economy and the market?
Yeah, that's, I mean, just imagine every day somebody's loan's coming due. And a lot of loans that came due in 2023 were pushed to 2024. So interestingly, going into this year, there was the assumption that there was about $600 to $700 billion of commercial real estate debt that would mature this year. Well, it turns out that number is closer to $1 trillion because a lot of 2023 maturities were pushed to 2024. So that industry needs a lot more equity. I think that's the bottom line. Either that, or there's going to be a lot of wipeout of existing equity that will transfer to the lenders via foreclosure and handing back the keys. So there's going to continue to be a bunch of pain for those operators that have debt coming due. If you own a multifamily building that's 98% leased and your maturity is not to 2027, 2028, or you're all equity, then you're fine. If you're in industrial warehousing, maybe your rent growth is slowing, also multifamily, but if you have a good balance sheet, you're okay. It's really going to affect the piece of that $20 trillion market of commercial real estate where your balance sheet is offsides, which obviously definitely ensnares a lot of people. And And we have to see how that sort of ripples into other parts of the economy. Also, higher for longer, when you think about its impact, you know, we talk about how it impacts existing businesses, existing real estate owners. But we also have to think about what higher interest rates mean for future economic activity. What business doesn't get started because VC money is not coming their way? What house is not being bought and instead is rented because the cost, you know, because interest rates are high on top of higher home prices for a millennial or Gen Zer who wants to buy? What business is not expanding because they don't feel like taking out a 10% loan from the bank? It's what activity does not take place because of higher interest rates in a very credit dependent economy.
And that'll take a little bit of time to figure out, right? If, you know, what isn't being done.
Right. That's why this is not sort of an easy, quick, you have the digestion of higher rates and then you move on. You know, this is something that plays out over many years because of the amount of debt that was priced pre-2022 that over the coming years will get repriced much higher. And if rates stay higher for a while, there's obviously sort of this pernicious death by a thousand cuts impact that I've been thinking is going to happen for a while now. And it sort of seems to me to be playing out in that fashion.
So the amount of debt that people take on, our government has taken on a ton of debt. And to finance that debt, we're selling bonds like it's going out of style. Peter, how is this affecting our economy? Because now the government's borrowing money, they're paying more to borrow that money. Our debt continues to rise. The bubble's got to burst at some point, don't you think?
Well, it's for 40 years we've been talking about wide U.S. budget deficits, you know, outside of a couple of years, and it never mattered. But to your question, is does it now matter? And I do think it does matter. I mean, in the 30 years I've been doing this, I never paid attention to the Treasury's quarterly refunding announcement, or over the last, you never really paid attention to Treasury auctions until the last couple of years. So now that we're talking about this and paying attention to it, it really is important. And when you have an expanding economy with an unemployment rate below 4% and a budget deficit relative to GDP at 6%, you know, that's highly stimulative. So there's basically $2 trillion more being spent relative to the income the government is collecting that's flowing through all parts of the economy. So here you have the Fed tightening, but fiscal policy continuing to ease. And question is can the U.S. Treasury continue to finance all this? And I do think it's getting more tougher around the edges. Now, the Fed has relieved some of that via trimming their QT from $60 billion a month in treasuries down to 25. So Janet Yellen got some relief, and not a coincidence that it's shortly before the election. But foreigners have also been a large contributor to financing the U.S. debt, and their percentage ownership of marketable securities, while they're still buying on an absolute basis, that percentage continues to drop. So more and more supply, wondering where the buyers come, could sort of flow in and give reason why, at least the long end of the yield curve, rates are going to stay high for a while as well, in addition to what the Fed does with the short end.
And I'm glad you mentioned the yield curve. Can you explain to me what's happening? I know with the yield curve, we kind of want to see it on an upward trajectory. It seems to have flattened out, even towards the end of it has come down a little bit. Explain to me what's happening with the yield curve.
Well, it's inversion, I think is the longest inversion that we've ever seen. And that's, again, this very strange nature of inflation and monetary policy in response and what I talked about with the U.S. financial situation and this very uneven economy. And also it does, you know, so there's always this debate is the inverted yield curve just reflective of the current economic situation, and or could it actually trigger a slowdown in bank lending because banks need a steep yield curve in order to make money? And I think it's a combination of both. Now, I do think that the yield curve is going to re-steepen and uninvert obviously, when the Fed starts to cut interest rates, even if they do it modestly, because I still expect higher, longer-term interest rates, actually counterintuitively too, if the Fed cuts short-term interest rates.
Have you seen this counterintuitive pattern before?
No, this seems to be pretty unique. I mean, typically where the Fed moves short-term interest rates, long-term interest rates sort of had followed. Now, that we had a little conundrum, as Greenspan called it, when he was raising rates in the mid-2000s and long-term interest rates didn't go up that much, and he called that a conundrum. But, you know, we had the fastest inflation in 40 years and the most aggressive monetary tightening in 40 years. So what we're seeing now is not something that many people in the markets are used to seeing. You have to sort of open up your history books for this. Not to say that this is the exact similar pattern as then, but there are definitely similarities and still a lot of distortions in a post-COVID world where the government has spent such extraordinary amounts of money to combat COVID. And that spending, from a baseline perspective, you know, never retraced itself.
So with bond prices where they are, would this be a good time to sort of put some money in that vehicle?
So we agree, but mostly owning shorter duration bonds. I have no interest in taking interest rate risk on the long end of the yield curve, which I think still very much exists. I do think that there are going to be some more temper tantrums in the long end of the U.S. yield curve, which may actually also occur in yield curves in Europe and Japan as well, as we all have some high correlations to each other's bond markets. So, but on the short end, where you can go out 2 to 3 years in terms of duration, yeah, for the first time in 15 years, there are actually attractive places to get some low risk, no risk if you're in treasuries, interest income.
Now, the European Central Bank is probably right on the verge of a rate cut, and the Bank of Japan is thinking about that as well. Is things loosening a little bit in overseas?
Well, Bank of Japan's actually thinking about raising rates, not cutting again. So we had the Riksbank today in Sweden that cut interest rates, sort of front-running what the ECB is likely to do. You know, Europe's economic situation is certainly much more muted than other parts of the world. So they're leaning more towards focused on that slow growth and the downward trajectory of inflation and feeling the need that that could be enough to tweak rates lower. We'll see what the Bank of England does. With Japan, you know, they obviously got out of negative interest rates and yield curve control, but now they're dealing with this pronounced weakness in the yen that resulted in two rounds of foreign exchange intervention, which won't last unless the BOJ further raises interest rates. And interestingly enough, Governor Ueda, speaking to Parliament this week, actually said and raised the possibility of them using monetary policy to stem the decline in the yen, which I think is definitely a change of tone of his, because they realize that a weak yen, when inflation is already higher, and particularly when it comes to what they import, food and energy, you really don't want to piss off your citizenry by depressing the value of your currency when you need to buy and import a lot of these non-discretionary items.
Yeah, I was actually reading your article and your quotes from the governor saying that a weak yen doesn't do anybody any good, and certainly not the citizens of Japan any good. So they're obviously looking to tighten things up a little bit. Let's come back to home and talk about wages a little bit. And you know, I was reading a report how, you know, wages are up, but they're creeping up at a much lower rate. Is that what the Fed is looking for? And how is that going to affect our economy? Because prices of goods are not coming down, so things are going to seem like they're a little bit more expensive.
Well, the wage growth is definitely moderating, but part of that also is just tougher comparisons. You know, when you have to comp against the very strong wage growth last year, you're just, the math is going to show you a deceleration. So that I think is a key part of that. Now, the Fed's sort of relationship with wages is definitely polluted here, is that they want to generate a higher inflation when inflation is low, but then we finally get it and wages start to go up to compensate for that high inflation, but then the Fed doesn't want higher wages because they're worried about that then furthering further price increases. Some higher wages sometimes leads to higher prices, sometimes it does not. It all depends on the productivity of that business. Now, if you're a restaurant in California who just had an increase in your minimum wage bill, if you're a fast food franchisee, to $20, well, you're raising your prices. And from what we've seen, restaurants are raising their prices from 6 to 8%. So whatever wage benefit someone in California is getting, it's being completely offset by a higher cost of living. So, but from the Fed's, you know, econometrically driven mind, yes, they're happy with the slowdown in the rate of wage increases.
Do we expect to see prices come down a little bit now that the wages aren't coming down, but they're stabilizing somewhat? Do we expect the prices to come down a little bit at some point?
No, prices will never come down. Maybe they'll just go up less, unfortunately, for those that have suffered through a very sharp rise in their cost of living. When it comes to wages, just for perspective, in the 20 years leading into COVID, average hourly earnings were averaged about 2.5% year over year. So now they've moderated, but they're still running at about 4. So that's off the boil of north of 5, but still running well above where it was pre-COVID. Now, for the wage earner, that's a good thing because of you know, higher inflation, but it definitely, from the Fed's perspective, certainly makes their job more difficult. And California, as I said, their minimum wage increase certainly doesn't make the Fed's job easier either if all of that wage increase gets passed through to higher prices, which it seems to have been. There's only so much productivity a restaurant can instill in its business.
Let's talk about unemployment for a second since we're talking about wages. The unemployment rate ticked up slightly, although we're hearing, Peter, about layoffs all over the place, layoffs that don't seem to have hit the numbers yet. Do we expect to see those hit the numbers, or are these people getting packages where they're told, yeah, don't apply for unemployment, stuff like that?
Well, I'd caution people when you hear about job cuts, that always makes the headlines.
Right.
When you hear about a big company hiring 5,000 new people, that doesn't necessarily get it. I do think, though, as we've seen in initial jobless claims, that the pace of firings remains somewhat muted. Now, we can quibble with the jobless claim number because if you get a severance package, you're not necessarily applying for unemployment benefits. And there are some people that, for some reason, don't think it's worthwhile because it doesn't offset their cost of living, or they're not eligible, whatever. But I think the labor market change that, to me, is becoming more evident is the slowdown in the pace of hiring. And we've seen that in the NFIB, and we've seen it in a lot of the anecdotal softer data rather than the BLS data. I think the BLS data is still being overstated. ADP is still showing some pretty good job growth, but if you look at NFIB intentions to hire, that's fallen dramatically. If you look at continuing claims, those are still collecting benefits, that's remaining elevated near multi-year highs. We looked at the Conference Board Consumer Confidence Survey last week, and the answers to labor market questions weakened. Even within the BLS jobs report last week, those that can't find full-time work and are working part-time because of that, or working part-time because they're slack work, that those numbers are actually increasing. Hours worked fell. So to me, that there's a clear slowing of demand for workers. And I think that that is something that we have to pay attention to. Now, whether that starts to flip to firings, we'll have to see, because a lot of employers are reluctant to lay off workers that took them so much time and effort to get back after COVID.
Is there I was reading a report that there's a change in the open job status, that number is coming down. Have you seen that as well?
Yeah, so that number has receded as well. So sort of adding to this matrix of a lessened demand for new workers, not necessarily shifting to a layoff phase, but lessened demand for new hires.
So let's start to talk about some happy stuff, things that, you know, we can help people make some money. We're coming into the tail end of earnings. I know that McDonald's and those companies said that they were going to probably enter a price war to try and get more business. They might be going through a price war in their own company with people going away from the quarter pounder and buying something a little less expensive. But what are you seeing in earnings season that thinks that, look, maybe the economy is still doing okay?
So when we go into an earnings season, you have to assume that about 75% of companies will beat EPS estimates. That is just the going rate, call it. And according to FactSet, I think for Q1, that number was about 77%. So call it slightly better, but only slightly. On the revenue side, only about 60% of companies exceeded expectations. Usually the average is closer to 70. And even earnings, now you have to also keep in mind with earnings is there's so many variables. It's what your tax rate is and what sort of unusual stuff, who's reporting GAAP earnings, who's reporting non-GAAP earnings. So I always feel it's important to sort of look under the hood of what the headline numbers read about earnings. You know, earnings season's great because 77% of companies beat expectations, like I said, but as I also said, only slightly, that's only slightly above. And what were the real reasons for the beats? As I mentioned, revenue numbers were actually disappointing. So it's, but like I said, there's pockets of strength. If you're Vulcan Materials and you're selling aggregates to rebuild roads, well, you're doing fine. If you're building steel and electrification equipment that's going into a new battery facility in Kansas, well, you know, you're doing fine. If, like we talked about the cruise line stocks, you're doing fine. If you're Marriott that's relying on travel, particularly international travel, you're doing fine. So it all depends on who you're sort of catering to. If you're in the real estate brokerage business, you're in a lot of pain. If you're a big home builder, you're doing fine. If you're in parts of the industrial manufacturing world, like if you're selling, here's a perfect example of this mixed and uneven. If you're a semiconductor company that's selling chips into the industrial world, well, that business is down because there's still continued inventory destocking going on. If you're also selling into the data center that's benefiting from AI spend, well, your business is doing better. So the answer really is it all depends.
So is the AI craze still something that we're going to be riding for a period of time?
Well, the AI craze and capital spending will continue for the next couple of years. The capital spending numbers from Meta, Microsoft, Google, Amazon are just off the charts. Now, what return on that investment we get, I think, remains to be seen.
What other sectors? Now, I know that, you know, housing, if you're a housing builder, you said you're doing very, very well. But with interest rates the way they are, do you expect that to wane a little bit?
Well, it hasn't yet, because builders, the bigger builders, have been able to mitigate those higher interest rates via mortgage rate buydowns, teaser rates, or other discounting. So that's one of the reasons why they've been able to continue on with good volumes, because they can magically turn a 7.5% mortgage rate to 5.5% via that buydown. A smaller builder doesn't necessarily have that same flexibility. So that has definitely helped to drive more volume in that. Then, of course, you also have all cash buyers. You have some of those new builds going to community developers that will then take those new houses and rent them out. So it's not necessarily the end user that are buying that those homes. It's the single family rent, buy to rent, or I should say, own to single family rentals that are also buying those new homes too.
So is this a good time to put your money in gold? It seems like it's a little bit more stable. It creeps up, it comes down, but it's staying a lot more stable than some of the stocks that we're looking at.
Well, I'm a little biased because we're very long gold and silver, and we have been for years. So this run higher, we finally are enjoying. But I do think that there is a lot more upside to come for gold and silver. Silver is sort of lagging gold for sure, but we're still bullish, we're still long, and we still expect much higher prices.
Given the geopolitical stuff we're going through, it seemed to me that oil should be creeping up, but it's under $80 a barrel. Just a few weeks ago, it was $85, and now it's just under $80 a barrel. That also seems to be against the grain, as I would say.
Well, I think it It is because there hasn't been really any supply disruptions yet. So we have the worry of geopolitics, but the reality of no change in oil delivery supply chains. Now, there obviously have been some disruptions in the Red Sea, but that's more on the container side. But actual production and delivery of crude oil, that has not been affected yet. And that's why oil prices are where they are. Then, of course, you also have worries about the demand side with China and even in the US and Europe. So a lot of those sort of cross currents. But either way, oil's still around $80. And, that's still, at least now we're in the summer driving season, gasoline prices are, people are now focused on it again after, some relief that we had during the winter.
So I know you're pressed for time, but the million-dollar question: how do we make money in today's economy and with everything that's going in the market?
So we remain, I mentioned precious metals, but we're long and bullish on a bunch of different parts of the commodity landscape. Energy, agriculture, particularly fertilizer stocks. Also bullish on some of the industrial metals like copper and some of the stocks in that industry. I still think that there's been just a dramatic pace of underinvestment in commodities over the past decade as everyone shifted to spending on technology and other things. If you're a VC, investing in that new copper mine was not that sexy. Other things was more attractive. So I do think that prices on the commodity space are going to be high for a while and will go higher. And I still think that there are a lot of areas of commodity stocks that are cheap, particularly agriculture. That's one of our newer positions over the last couple of months, is buying some of the fertilizer stocks, and that I think that have a bunch of upside. And also, we also invest very internationally, and I still find markets in Asia very attractive, particularly in Hong Kong, which has been a dramatic underperformer up until recently, where one of my contrarian calls going into this year was the Hang Seng was going to outperform the S&P. And after a pretty brutal start to that call, with the Hang Seng down 10% in January, it's finally done a lot of catch up. So I think there are opportunities in Asia to play the growing middle class there.
So that's how to make money. How do we protect ourselves from the volatility, some of the volatility that we've seen? Someone who's maybe on a little bit more of a fixed income.
Well, you can never really protect yourself completely if you want to be invested in the markets. The only way you're fully protected is if you're in a treasury money market. But I think people just have to learn to live with the volatility. And I think extending out one's time horizon is the best way to deal with short-term volatility. Because if you know you have that long-term time horizon, you can deal with a lot of the short-term noise.
Peter, last question. Are we in a position now where, maybe the Fed will think about an interest rate cut? Do we have to retrain ourselves? We're long. I think that the time of zero interest rates are long gone. We need to now retrain ourselves to say, 3-4%, maybe that's not so bad.
I agree. And the level of interest rates, even where we are today, historically speaking, is somewhat normal. The problem is that 15 years of zero interest rates was very abnormal. So there is a transition period that takes place not without pain. So at some point, we're going to get to a better place where the whole economy adjusts to this higher interest rate environment, particularly relative to the rate of inflation, which is a normal good thing. But that's still a transition to be had. But to your point, yes, the days of zero interest rates are over, and I do say good riddance to them.
Well, Peter, I know that we can find you on Substack with your the book report. Where else can we find you, or is that the best place to find you?
Well, if they want to read my daily work, they can go there. If they want to learn about our wealth management services, they can go to our website, bleakley.com.
Peter, thanks so much. This was great, and I appreciate it, and I hope to have you back again soon.
Thanks, Andrew. We'd be happy to.
That's a wrap on another discussion here on Wealthion. Thank you for joining us. If you need help being financially resilient, please head over to wealthion.com and sign up for a free, no obligation consultation with one of our registered investment advisors. And remember to follow us on social media for the latest news and information to help you invest wisely. And if you could like and subscribe to the channel, we'd greatly appreciate it. Don't forget to hit the notification bell so you can find out when we post new videos to the channel. Thanks again for watching, and until next time, stay informed, be empowered, and may your investments flourish.